All right. Well, 2 Kings 3, just a bit of an overview. Obviously, we're kind of moving into the ministry of Elisha. We've seen Elijah kind of die. He got raptured, if you guys remember, a couple chapters ago. Chapter 2, I guess it was. You guys remember when God was communicating to him in, he was in Beersheba and then went down to Mount Sinai, was hiding from God after the whole Baal incident on Mount Carmel, and God asked Elijah to do three things before he died. You guys remember what those were?
There were two kings.
Anoint two kings. One was Jehu, king in Israel. The other one was
pass the torch to Elisha.
King of Aram, Syria is what it was. So we've got Ben-Hadad on the throne right now, and Hazael is going to be the next guy. And then one other thing. Anoint Elijah. Okay, so those are the three things he's supposed to do. Okay, he apparently went 0 for 3 on all of them. The text doesn't tell us that he did them. Elisha will do those, but there's some questions to what he did. So as we're moving now into Elisha's life, we're going to see those things fulfilled, but they're going to get fulfilled through Elisha. Okay, so big picture now. Chapter 3 of 2 Kings, we're in the midst of that. Jehoram is the current king on the block in the east. So east, sorry. Looking at the wrong side of my chart. Read this way. In the north, in Israel, I should say. Okay. And then you've got Jehoram, who's the king now that we're going to see in the south in Judah. Okay. So just with our bearings on that. It's odd that we're going to have two kings in two different areas with the same name reigning at the same time. So that gets a little bit confusing. But we'll make sense of it, hopefully, this morning. So with that, let me pray, and we will we'll work through this. God, thanks for this morning. Thank you for an opportunity to get up and to study your Bible. Lord, as we seek to continue to work through the lives of these kings, many of whom are, Lord, unfamiliar to us and areas of Scripture that maybe aren't is read as often maybe as others, Lord. Let's pray that you would continue to do a great work within us, that you would minister to our hearts. And as Lord, we just have literally weeks left at this point. Would you help us to finish strong? God, I know many in here are weary, tired, and life is happening with finals and papers and projects and just, Lord, everything else that just inundates us outside of residency. Lord, give us strength to finish strong. Help us to be attentive here, to be Lord, just cognizant of what you're doing in our lives at a heart level, Lord, and pray that, God, the lives of these kings, through Elisha, through the men and women of God that you're using in these stories, Lord, would you teach us, God, we pray. In Christ's name, amen. All right, so chapter 3, 2 Kings, let's pick up there. Jehoram, current king in the north and south, for that matter, as well, but we'll look at the one now here in 2 Kings 3. So I'm going to pick up there in verse 1. All right. Again, we see, sorry, Cass, we see Jeroboam being the unfortunate model king in the north, the guy that started Baal worship and started really, I guess not Baal worship, but started deviant worship of God, creating his own system of worship. We remember about him with Dan and Bethel. He created golden calves in each of the cities. You guys remember this guy? And he continues to be the measuring rod for all the kings after him. So terrible dude. This guy who is Ahab's son. You guys remember on, again, the right side of your chart, you've got Ahab, you've got Ahaziah, who was the king that reigned after him, which was Ahab's first son. He's the guy that fell off the lattice, whether he was intoxicated or what, I don't know, but pretty hard to fall off your roof otherwise. So wouldn't be a big surprise. And then you've got Jehoram, his brother, or Ahab's other son. Okay, so that's kind of where we're at in the picture. So he does better, but still evil. So I guess it's when you're just talking about all horrible kings, there's just degrees of evil at this point. Less evil and more evil. So, verse 4, you see Misha, the king of Moab, used to be subject to Ahab. Ahab dies, and this guy says, you know what? The heck with you. I'm not paying you tribute anymore. He used to give Ahab, we see in verse 4, 100,000 lambs and 100,000 rams every year. He rebels, and now Jehoshaphat, the same guy, the same king in the south, he's currently on the throne right now. Sorry, we'll see Jehoram here in a second, the next king in the south. He goes now to Jehoshaphat and says, hey, let's unite. Let's go against this king of Moab who's rebelled against us. And you're going to see something in here that sounds like you've seen it before, okay? Ahab did this with Jehoshaphat. Now, Ahab's son is doing this with Jehoshaphat. Here's Jehoshaphat's answer in verse 7. All right, now remember Ahab asked the same thing of Jehoshaphat a couple chapters ago. He basically gave the exact same answer. Okay, why is that a concern? I mean, what does that mean again? Your people are my people, horses are your horses. What is he saying? Basically, yeah, we're totally united in all this, right? We're the same. It's like, well, wait a second. You guys are worshiping Baal. We're trying not to do that. We're trying to follow God in obedience here down in Judah, and you guys are not. But when you ask me to align with you, I'm all in, okay? That sounds very noble until we see down on your chart, look, two more kings down after Jehoram. So you got Jehoshaphat, Jehoram, Ahaziah, and then you have the Athaliah rebellion. Athaliah is going to be the queen in Israel, or in Judah, rather, at this point. She is a gift given from Ahab. That's Ahab's daughter. And because Jehoshaphat was so concerned about uniting the kingdoms, in order to do that, Ahab gave a gift of his daughter to Jehoshaphat. Well, Jehoshaphat's son is going to marry said daughter, and she is a disaster. She's like Jezebel all over again, but now in the south instead of the north. So he wanted to reunite the kingdoms, which is noble and good, but he compromised in the midst of that. So he tries to do this to his own detriment, if you will. So he says, yeah, I'll go up. Let's go to war against the king of Moab. Same conversation they had in the past. Like, Ahab wants to go seek a prophet. Jehoshaphat says, man, is there somebody, like, of God that we could actually talk to instead of your pagan Baal, Asherah-worshipping prophets? And Jehoshaphat says in the same in verse 11, is there not a prophet of the Lord here that we may inquire and find out what the will of God is in regards to this matter? And lo and behold, they find Elisha. And Elisha comes down and says, man, I'll minister to you guys. I'll communicate what God's will is. Look at now at verse 13, and this is Elisha's conversation with them. What does that mean? Go worship your Baal prophets, right? What do I have to do with you? Which to this pagan king in the north, right, this in disobedience, that's his answer. And Elisha says, man, in verse 14, had I had not regard for Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, you wouldn't even have an audience with me today. So he says, now verse 15, bring me a guitar, a minstrel, give me something to play some music with. And he says, listen, you're going to see a miracle tomorrow because of Jehoshaphat, because he's at least involved in this situation. God is going to bring a miracle. And he, in verse 17, in this drought, they say, you shall not see wind, nor shall you see rain, yet the valley shall be filled with water, so that you shall drink both you and your cattle and your beasts. We're going to fill this entire valley with water where you're sitting, and it's going to come from Moab, okay, or from Edom on the east side of the Jordan. It happened in the morning, verse 20, at the time of the offering sacrifice, that behold, water came by the way of Edom, and the country was filled with water. Now, for those of you guys that have been to Israel, all two of you, how do you get water off of the mountains with no rain or no storm in that area? Flash floods, okay? Wadis, three of you, sorry, not two. So when we were in Israel, was that with you that we were on that trip? It was a June trip. They never get rain in June. It's like rain in July in Fresno. It doesn't happen except for an act of God. I think I've told you guys this before. There was a flash flood further up in the mountains of in the Judah mountains, and it flooded down at the Dead Sea area. And man, when it rains up there, it floods down there, and there are flash floods all through the wadis. So God brings literally rain on the mountains of Edom, not rain where they are at, and flash floods now fill this valley and this land now that they're in. And God has basically solved the problem in a second of this drought that they were currently in. So God shows up, they see this incredible thing. And the Moabites think, man, this isn't water, this is blood. Verse 21, they arose in the morning. The Moabites saw the water opposite them as red as blood. And they said, surely, in verse 23, the kings have fought against each other and they've all died. Like this, they fill literally the valley with their blood. So they come in now, the Moabites do, to rush in to try to destroy Israel, and then realize, oh, wow, this actually isn't blood. This is water. And the kings that were in hiding, basically, they knew that this would be the Moabites' plan of attack. They now hide, and they come out to kill them. And the king of Moab, as he is losing the battle in verse 27, does something very, very odd. We've never seen this before, and it's so heinous. It basically is a battle-ending decision. So he realizes, literally, he's got 700 men left in verse 26. He realizes he's going to die. He's going to lose the battle. So in verse 27, this is what the king of Moab does.
He took his oldest son, who was to reign in his place, and offered him for a burnt offering on the wall. And there came great wrath against Israel, and they withdrew from him and returned to their own land.
Now, read in between the lines for me. You know a little bit about Moab and the Moabites. Why would a king offer his oldest son on a wall as a burnt offering?
Going to be to Chemosh.
To Chemosh, right? Child sacrifice. Now, we don't know how old his son is at this point, but if he's going to be the next king, we're going to assume he's probably not an infant. So this is a, he may have been out there at battle, like with this guy, and he offers his son as a burnt offering, human sacrifice. And the Israelites see this and went, whoa, we're just going to go home. We're done here. So they literally leave. A great wrath came against Israel. So you're beginning to see, this is like Judges-esque and how dark it is during this day. We're going to see a couple more evidences of this that unfortunately are even worse than this. We've seen child sacrifice before. But not in this context. So both kings now, Jehoram, same name, return now and basically go home.
So that wrath that was against them, is that from God?
Yeah, I would assume so. It doesn't specifically say it, but I think God just kind of put the e-brake on and said, we're done. And yeah, so didn't want him to win the rest of the battle or what have you. So, yep. Okay. In verse 1 of chapter 4 now, turning back to Elisha, we're going to see a couple of this guy's miracles. Okay. 4 verse 1, we saw Elijah, and a lot of his ministry was like big, big miracles, right? With Baal and on a mountain and me versus 950 prophets. Elisha's ministries tend to be and his miracles, rather, tend to be much more individualistic, much more personal. Okay, and here's an example of one. Okay, 4 verse 1.
A certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elisha, saying, your servant, my husband, is dead, and you know that your servant feared the Lord, and the creditor is coming to take to take my two sons to be his slaves.
All right, so this woman, this in Israel again, and in this culture, one of the least and the last, this woman who's about to have a husband die, has nothing, and now she's wondering, gosh, is someone like me, do I matter to God? Will Elisha show up and minister to me? And Elisha said to her, what do you need? What do you have, basically? And she says at the end of verse 2, your maidservant has nothing in this house except a jar of oil. Mm-hmm. That's it, okay? So he says now in verse 3, go borrow vessels, large vessels for yourself from all your neighbors, even empty vessels. And he says in verse 3, do not get a few. Go borrow a bunch of vessels. And then in verse 6, it says, she came about when the vessels were full that she said to her son, bring me another vessel. He said, bring it. He brought it to her. And then end of verse 6, there is none. Not one vessel more, and the oil had stopped. So God miraculously provides all this oil and all these vessels that she had basically borrowed from her neighbors. And Elisha says now in verse 7, go sell your oil, pay your debt, and you and your sons can live on the rest. So God miraculously provides probably olive oil in this culture for this woman to live, now to live on for her, to heat her home, to sell the rest in the market, and to live on. So just, again, a snippet of God's concern through Elisha of the folks in that culture that would have been deemed the least and the last, a widow who had no provisions except for her son, who apparently wasn't helpful in this matter. God now uses this guy, Elisha, to minister to this woman. Okay, so we've got a least and the last woman here. Verse 8 now, we're going to have a very well-to-do woman in a very different circumstance. Pick up there and let's see now another of Elisha's ministries, or miracles rather.
Now it happened one day that Elisha went to Shunem, where there was a notable woman, and she persuaded him to eat some food. So it was after it was as often as he passed by, he would turn in there and eat some food.
So this woman provides for the ministry of Elisha. Okay, Shunem is, by the way, it's in the Jezreel Valley, just east of Megiddo. So we're in that area. And she is so impressed with this guy. She says in verse 10, please let us make a little walled upper chamber. Let us set a bed in there for him, a table and a chair and a lampstand. And it shall be when he comes, he has a place to stay. So, hey, heard about your ministry. Love what you're doing. We're going to basically put an addition on our house and you're going to live there. So anytime you need like a bed and breakfast as you're rolling through town, doing your thing and like miracles or whatever it is that you do, Elisha, come stop at our house and have a meal. And he says, man, that's fantastic. So you see this picture. This woman has the ability not just to provide for herself and for her husband, but for others. So she's fine. She's well off. She's upper middle class. Okay, she's living life. Okay. Now, verse 11. One day he came there, turned to the upper room, and Elisha says to Gehazi, his servant, "Man, I want to take care of this woman. How do I say thank you?" Okay. And in verse 13, he says as much, and her answer at the end of verse 13 is interesting. She answered and said, "I live among my own people." So Elisha basically says, "Hey, how do I return this favor to you?" And she says, "I live among my own people." What does that mean? It's an odd response. Any ideas? She wants a what? I'm sorry. I have no idea. I'm just answering because nobody else is, and I'm tired of the silence. I think what she's saying is, hey, I'm good. I got a house. I live amongst my own people. All my needs are provided for. Life's fine, right? I got a mortgage, but I can take care of everything. I'm good. I don't need anything from you, okay? And that's not arrogant. That's not there's no pride in that. I think she's just saying, listen, as I look around at the needs of my life, I have none. God's taking care of me. So Elisha wants to provide for her, and she says, man, I have need of nothing. Now, we're going to find out she does have need of something, but she doesn't want to ask because it's too close to her heart. So in verse 14, keep reading.
So he said, what then is to be done for her? So Gehazi answered, actually, she has no son for her, and her husband is old.
So what kind of condition are her and her husband in? He's old, right? She's barren, or for whatever reason, they don't have a kid. Now, we're going to find out that's a desire of her heart, but it's so intimate and it's so personal, she doesn't want to even ask Elisha about it. Okay, so Elisha realizes, man, this gal has no son. That was actually her desire. And he says in verse 15, call her. She stands now in the doorway. In verse 16, he said, at this season next year, you shall embrace a son. Listen to her answer, end of verse 16.
And she said, no, my lord, man of God, do not lie to your maidservant.
Now, what does that mean? Don't get my hopes up. This is not possible. Like, why would you say that? This is like Abraham and Sarah-esque, right? Like, no, I'm 90 years old. Like, I'm not going to have, my husband's a hundo. Like, we're not having a kid, though. This is not going to happen. So she says, if you get my hopes up and you break my heart, like, there's nothing more that I want in this world than that. Everything else I provided for and I can fix with my own means, but not this. And lo and behold, watch what happens in verse 17.
But the woman conceived and bore a son when the appointed time had come of which Elisha had told her.
Wow. So does God show up and provide for this woman? Absolutely. Verse 18, this is odd.
And the child grew. Now it happened one day that he went out to his father, to the reapers. And he said to his father, my head, my head. So he said to his servant, carry him to his mother. When he had taken
So he's outside with his dad working in the fields, and he's screaming about a headache. So his head's killing him. Don't know what it is. And they said, man, take him inside. Verse 20.
When he had taken him and brought him to his mother, he sat on his knees until noon and then died.
Wow. So how are you feeling right now if you're this woman? You're furious. The one thing I always wanted my whole life, I didn't even ask for it. Elisha gives to me, God gives to me, and then you take my kid away, however much, you know, whatever the time gap is in between these two events. So how do you feel about God right now? Confused? I mean, come on, be honest. Feels a little cruel right now. Like, why would a God do that? Why would he give something and then take it away? Like, that's not a loving God. That's a cruel God. That's awful. So she's rightly upset and doesn't quite know how to process what she's feeling. Now, why would God be doing this to her? Think about it. Elisha says, hey, what do you need? And what does she say? I don't need anything. My life's good. I'm dependent on me. I don't need you. I have everything I need. I'm taken care of. And God says, man, I don't think that's the case. So I'm going to put you in a place where you can see that your things, your provisions aren't going to take care of you. You're going to have to lean on me. God provides her a son, and she sees that. Okay, that didn't come from me. Now I'm going to take your son away, and you're going to realize your resources, the things that I have blessed you with, aren't going to fix this problem. Now who are you going to lean on? Yourself? Oh, that's not going to work. Now who are you going to turn to? Okay, 21, she went up and laid on him on the bed. The man of God shut the door, and in verse 22, she calls now to her husband and says, please send one of the servants that he may run and tell the man of God. So she wants Elisha to come back. And he says, man, it's going to be tough. It's not the right time for him to be here. Verse 24, she saddled a donkey, said to her servant, go forward, find basically Elisha. She went in verse 25 to the man of God of Carmel. Came about when the man of God saw her at a distance that he said to Gehazi, his servant, behold, there is the Shunammite. Okay, I know that woman. Please run to her, 26, and say, what do you need? They meet, and she says, it is well. Like, no, it's not well. She doesn't want to talk to Gehazi. Gehazi came to meet her, and she says, I want to meet with Elisha. You bring him to me. And she's got business to do with him as well, not just God. 27, keep going.
Now, when she came to the man of God at the hill, she caught him by his feet. But Gehazi said, I came near to push her away. But the man of God said, let her alone, for the soul, for her soul is in deep distress, and the Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me.
All right, so Elisha sees, man, this woman's a wreck and doesn't know why. And in 28, she finds out why. He finds out why.
So she said, did I ask a son of my Lord? Did I not say, do not deceive me? Then she
is that right? Like, did I ask for a son? No. Did I tell you don't deceive me? Yes. Like, why would you do this? Do you see where she's at with Elisha and in a sense with God? Like, did I ask you for a son? Was I discontent and complaining in Eeyore life? No, like, I wanted one, but I didn't let it ruin my life. I lived my life, and then you gave me a kid, and then you took my kid away. Like, I'd have been better off had you never provided me a kid. That's her thinking at this point, okay? 29, keep going.
Then he said to, what's his name?
Gehazi.
Gehazi, get yourself ready and take my staff in your hand and be on your way. If you meet anyone, do not greet him. And if anyone greets you, do not answer him. But lay my staff on the face of the child.
Okay, so Elisha just says, send Gehazi and take my staff, okay? The mother says in verse 30, as the Lord lives and you yourself live, I will not leave you. Meaning, Elisha, get off your derriere. You're coming. I don't want to talk to Gehazi. I don't want to deal with Gehazi. Gehazi passed on before them and laid the staff on the lad's face, but there was neither response nor sound. So Gehazi's attempting to resurrect this kid from the dead, and there's nothing. So he returned to meet him and said, the lad has not awakened. Elisha came into the house, and behold, the lad was dead and laid on his bed. She entered and shut the door. He entered and shut the door behind both of them and prayed to the Lord. Verse 34, he went up and lay on the child. He put his mouth on his mouth, his eyes on his eyes, his hands on his hands. He stretched himself on the child, and the flesh of the child became warm. 35, then he returned, walked into the house once back and forth, went up and stretched himself on him again, and the lad sneezed 7 times and opened his eyes. Sneezing is kind of odd that it would show up here. There's a Jewish belief that Adam sneezed after he was created, so it was the sense of life Y'all figure it out. But that's the connection, at least in a Jewish thought, that this would have meant, man, there's indeed life in this kid. He calls Gehazi and says, call the Shunammite. He called her and said, take up your son. 37. Watch what happens now at the end of this gal's story. 37.
So she went in, fell at his feet and bowed to the ground. Then she picked up her son and went out.
Okay. So she has a very different understanding. Now, why would God have taken this woman through this journey, right? Provides her a child, kills the child, brings the child back to life. Why not just give her a child to be done with it? Or just not give her a child at all? What's God doing here? Yeah. There's a faith journey for this gal that you can't produce what this would have produced in this gal's heart without trials, without difficulty, without taking something away from this gal that was her most prized possession, not out of cruelty, not because he's a mean God, but because he's trying to bolster her faith and say, man, life doesn't happen on your own. Like, you can't just provide for yourself in every means. There's a point where you're going to hit the end of your rope, and I'm going to take you there on purpose, and then I'm going to take you past there and see if you'll depend on me. And this gal, though she's mad and she's frustrated, responds and says, Elisha, man, did I ask for this? Did I not ask you not to deceive me? God shows up again, and at the end of her journey, has her child, what she had wanted in her heart that she didn't even ask for, who's now living, but she also has with it a very, very different view of God. Would you agree? Fascinating. And God is showing her that I care about even you, an older gal married to a dude who has a need of a kid, and you've never even expressed that need or that desire. I'll minister to you. Yeah, and the Marys are furious. Like, man, had you showed up, like, my son or my brother wouldn't be dead, right? So there's definitely some connections there. So remember that in your lives as God is dealing with difficulty in you. And again, it's so hard in the midst of trials and frustrating times to remember that. God is doing something in those trials and in those moments that that's his instrument. And that doesn't occur in lecture. It only occurs in lab. And we have to go through lab to learn some of these things. So this gal did it, and I would argue that her faith is stronger, her knowledge of God, her love for God, her view of God, all of those things are better, and they have changed as a result of this, okay? So 38 and following, Elisha basically takes a bunch of single dudes who don't know how to cook and have poisoned their stew and fixes it, okay? It's like a fraternity chapter. It's odd. We won't read it all, but that's the idea. So verse 38, they find out that these guys, these prophets, basically, they're not fraternity guys for real, but they're prophets, basically picked the wrong stuff in the fields. They made this stew to eat, and it's bad. And Elisha fixes it in verses 41 and following. Okay, so that's that story. Now, chapter 5. Naaman and Elisha. Naaman is a guy that is, you probably heard of his name before if you've worked through 2 Kings. This guy's a cool guy. 5 verse 1, let's pick up on his story.
Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, was a great man with his master and in high favor, because by him the Lord had given victory to Syria. He was a mighty man of valor, but he was a leper.
All right, so Naaman is a Syrian, okay? He's the captain of the bodyguard of the enemy. That's how we get 2 alarms going off. Will a guy go walk back there? Okay, I'm just making sure. I hear car alarms out here. Okay, very good. So, you're all fired. We're going to have to dock your pay for that. No worries. All right, just making sure we're all copacetic here. So, we had a first year residency. I was in the middle of teaching. What was it? It's Genesis 2. So we're talking about being made in the image of God, right? And I'm up here teaching, and there's like 11 of us in the room. We're at the old offices, kind of off Crystal and Avenue, or Shaw and West, like way out there. And the area that we lived in just had a bunch of homeless people that were in. It was kind of an odd area. And I'm in the middle of teaching about valuing people that don't look like us, that don't talk like us, that are made in the image of God, that are different than us. And this gal walks in, this African-American old lady, older lady, that was off her medications, I found out later. Literally, I'm in the middle of teaching this, and she walks in, and she's like, "Where's Brad Bell? Hi, like, who are you?" I don't know how she knew Brad's name, how she knew we were at church. She goes off, right, for like 5 minutes, and I walk her out and talk to her for a little bit, and she leaves, and anyway, I walk back in. I'm like, that was odd. So anyway, long story short, I end up having lunch with this gal, like that day, right? Find out hardships in her life, and that she has this legitimate, just like horrible experience that caused a string of circumstances that happened. This gal's homeless, and anyway, got to talk to her and eat lunch with her and share a story, and she was hanging out at the well all the time. Her name was Mrs. Brown. So, like, she showed up on one of the residency finals 1 year, so as the example of the imago Dei, of being made in the image of God, of that woman who's hot flaming mad at Brad Bell for whatever reason, so is made in the image of God, and, you know, whatever. So it was one of those crazy days. So you never know when alarms start going off what's going to happen. God may start giving us audio visuals, so you want to be listening. So there you go. All right, so back to Naaman. Okay, this guy is captain of the king's bodyguard of a pagan army. He's a valiant warrior, but he's a leper. Okay, so he's an outsider. Verse 2, keep rolling.
Now the Syrians, on one of their raids, had carried off a little girl from the land of Israel, and she worked in the service of Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "I wish that my lord were with the prophet who is in Samaria. He would cure him of his leprosy."
So this gal, this Israeli gal, ends up with Naaman in his household, and basically, sounds like she's treated well, and says, "Man, if you guys knew the prophet back home in my hometown, this guy could cure Naaman." So obviously he's affectionate towards this guy, wants to see him healed. And Naaman says, "Man, thus and thus spoke the girl. This is what she said." Verse 5, "The king of Aram said, 'Go now, I will send a letter to the king of Israel.'" So they don't know that it's Elisha. They think it's the current king, which is Jehoram at the time, in the south. I'm sorry, we're in Israel right now. So we are still on the other Jehoram. Sorry, so I was right, but wrong. "He departed, took with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothes." So king of Syria says, "Man, I can't fix this. Go to Jehoram and see if he can fix it." Brought a letter to the king of Israel in verse 6. And they basically told him the situation. "Your servant has leprosy. Why don't you cure him?" Okay, they bring this again to the king of Israel. Verse 7. This is a really funny response from the king of Israel.
"And when the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his clothes and said, 'Am I God to kill and to make alive, that this man sends word to me to cure a man of his leprosy?'"
What does that mean? What do you want me to do? I'm sorry. You want me to cure this guy of leprosy? Look, dude, I worship Baal. Like, no. And am I God? Like, I can't do that. So consider now. And see, he is seeking a quarrel against me. He sees this as like a trap. Like he's insulting me, asking me to cure his captain of his bodyguard of leprosy. So verse 8, though, it happens why Elisha, when Elisha, the man of God, heard about this, he says, "Man, you sent the letter to the wrong dude. Like you should have sent your letter to me. Let him come to me," he says at the end of verse 8. "He shall know that there is a prophet in Israel." So you want to see if God's still moving? He ain't moving through that pagan king of ours. However, he's moving through me. So you want to find out if there's a prophet in Israel? Bring that guy to me. And Naaman's desperate. He's a dude that's at the end of his rope. He's had leprosy his whole life. He cannot get cured. So Naaman came with his horses and his chariots and stood at the doorway of the house of Elisha. Verse 10, pick up there.
"And Elisha sent a messenger to him saying, 'Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times and your flesh shall be restored and you shall be clean.'"
So you want to be cured of leprosy? Go take 7 baths in the Jordan River. That seems like a great offer, yeah? Done. Verse 11, "Naaman is furious and went away and said, 'Behold, I thought he would surely come out to me and stand and call the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and cure the leper.'" So what is he saying? Say again, Stephen. Yeah, it wasn't convenient and it wasn't what I expected. I expect God to act like this. And when he doesn't act according to how I want him to act, I have the right, as the peon human, to get angry and tell God what I think about that. How do you think God's going to respond? Do you think he's going to go, "My bad, let me get my boy to come back, How do you want to wave his hand like this? More like this? Like both hands? Like, how do you want this to be done, Naaman? You think God's going to bow to that? Doubtful, right? This is a great example of how we act with God. Like, this is the box, God, that you fit in, and this is how I expect you to act in my life. This is how you were to behave. When I pull on knob B2, you deliver the goods out of the vending machine that I want, okay? This is who you are to me. And that's how Naaman views God. You're a vending machine, and I need of you. I need my leprosy healed, and I want it done my way. Now, he's going to basically say why he's furious. It's kind of funny, but it's actually very truthful. Verse 12, this is why he's ticked.
Are not Abana and
Farfar? Sure, that's why I'm not reading it.
Better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean? So he turned and went away in a rage.
What is he basically saying about Israel's river?
It sucks.
Jordan is nasty. Like, we got better rivers back home. Like, I'm not going to wash in your dirty river to get clean. It's one of the oxymorons, by the way, of going to Israel. Everybody wants to get baptized in the Jordan until you see the Jordan and go, ooh, it's not so pleasant. And the mighty Jordan of old isn't the mighty Jordan anymore. It's changed because of water rights and all this stuff. So as you're rolling like out of the Dead Sea, the Jordan's about that wide, right? And then north of the Sea of Galilee, it's flowing really well and you get baptized there. But it's still a little odd. It's just not the most like... We've got beautiful rivers in the States, right? You can think these picturesque canyons and clean water. That is not the Jordan, okay? So it's important to Israel, but he's right. He's like, look, dude, back in Damascus, we've got gorgeous rivers. I at least could have washed there. So he, verse 12, says, the heck with you. God, you're not going to act the way I expect you to act, so I'm going to turn away and go home mad. Like, that's his answer. So fascinating. Now, 13, he's going to get called to the carpet on this one. So what's this boy or this his servant say to Naaman? Why don't you just humble yourself and go do it? Had the prophet told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? What does that mean? What was washing in the Jordan for him? Simple and kind of beneath him, right? He is the captain of the army of Syria, who is the current reigning superpower in the world right now. They're the enemy of Israel. He's a big deal, and that's beneath him. So had he asked you to do some great thing, Naaman, would you have done it? The assumed answer is, yeah, because that would have met my expectations, because I'm a great man. And he says, but he asked you to wash in the Jordan, to humble yourself. Would you do that? He says, why don't you just go do it? How much more than when he says to you, wash and be clean? So will this not be even more significant that you're going to go wash in a dirty river and become clean? Like, why don't you just try it? So 14.
So he went down and dipped himself seven times in the Jordan, according to the word of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child.
How about that? Does God heal this guy? Does he deal with his arrogance? Yeah. Is he okay with it? Like, yeah, okay. He's an Aramean. That's fine. He got there, though. His heart changed in the midst of this, and he saw the fallacies, I guess, in his own thinking and says, man, you know what? You're right. I need to go do this. And his servant, by the way, is the one who rebukes the master and says, you should go do this, and he does. 15, this guy is going to walk away changed. This is pretty cool.
Then he returned to the man of God, he and all his company. And he came and stood before him, and he said, behold, I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel.
What is that, by the way? What is that statement? There is no God in all the earth except for in Israel.
Their God's the one true God.
That's called conversion right there. Your God is my God because he's the God and he's the only God. I mean, that is a statement of from a pagan God-worshipping home. He has changed his life. He's basically been baptized, if you will. He has identified himself as a follower of Yahweh. And not just a little bit. Watch what he does. Keep rolling.
So accept now a present from your servant. But he said, as the Lord lives, before whom I stand, I will receive none. And he urged him to take it, but he refused.
Now, why would Elisha say, you know what, dude, no. Thanks for your offer of a gift, but no, this is not appropriate time for me to take a gift from you. Why would Elisha say that? Yeah. It's like, man, you would misconstrue this that somehow I had something to do with this. Dude, I'm just the mouthpiece, right? And I didn't do this. You don't need to. This is not the appropriate time, okay? So Naaman said, okay, well, here's what I want. 17. What does he want? Two mules load of earth. What is that? I want two wheelbarrows full of Israeli dirt. What? Why does he want that? Yeah, what did you guys bring home when you went to Israel from the Elah Brook? A rock, right? Why do you want a rock? Well, that's where David slew Goliath, so I'm going to take a rock home with me, right? Okay, like, he's like, I want to remember this place. And not just remember it, he's got an idea behind why he would want dirt, Israeli dirt. And he basically says, here's the issue with my life that I got to go home to, verse 18.
In this matter, may the Lord pardon your servant. When my master goes into the house of Ramon to worship there, leaning on my arm, and I bow myself in the house of Ramon.
Okay, so he says, I got to go home, and my king worships this dude named Ramon, okay? And I got to go into his house and worship him. So God, would you pardon me for that? What do you suppose Naaman is going to do with this dirt? Where is he going to put it? Probably in this guy's house. So that when he's leaning and his master is praying to this God, he's going to lean on Israeli dirt and pray to the Israeli God, pray to the God of the Jews, and say, this is my God. And he's saying, Lord, will you pardon me for that? Like, I can't really get out of this situation. This is backwards, right? This is weird. So, God, are you okay with that? Can I go worship you in a pagan house? Can I go worship you in the house of Dagon, in the house of Chemosh? And he says, you know what? I feel you. And he says in verse 19, go in peace. So he departed from him and went on at a distance, okay? It's a cool story of this guy that, man, he doesn't come from Israel. He doesn't know the Mosaic law. He doesn't know all the ins and outs of what he's supposed to do to worship God. But is his heart right? Absolutely. Bring me some dirt so I can worship on my knees, on your dirt, and identify myself with your God. That's what I want to do. And God says, man, I like that. Absolutely. Game on. So it's a cool story of a guy that had to get humbled in this process and worships God in a weird way. But God is totally honored by it. So now the rest of the story is unfortunate. Okay. Verse 20.
Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, see, my master has spared this Naaman the Syrian, and not accepting from his hand what he brought. As the Lord lives, I will run after him and get something from him.
So Gehazi's watched this whole situation go down. Naaman gets out his checkbook and says, hey, what can I give you, Gehazi? Or what can I give you, Elisha? Elisha says, nothing. Gehazi watches this. He's like, what? This guy's going to offer you a check for the healing, and you don't want anything? He's like, if you're not going to take it, I'm going to take it. So he goes. 21, Gehazi pursued Naaman. They have a conversation, and he says in verse 22, this is now Gehazi speaking with Naaman.
22?
Yep.
And he said, all is well. My master has sent me to say, there have just now come to me from the hill country of Ephraim two young men of the sons of the prophets. Please give them a talent of silver and two changes.
So what does Gehazi tell Naaman? A lie. I need some money, and I need a new wardrobe. So can you hook me up with that? And Naaman's like, oh, okay, I guess Elisha changed his mind. Nope, no problem. Take two talents. Here's some money. He urged him and bound the two talents of silver with two bags and gave him the changes of clothes as he asked. And said, great, you know, I'm happy to do it. He has no idea that he's being lied to. When he came from the hill, he took them from their hand, deposited them in the house, and went and sent the men away, and they departed. Verse 25, when he went and stood before his master, Elisha said to him, where have you been, Gehazi? What does that sound like to you? Garden. It sounds just like the garden, right? Adam, where are you? Did you eat of the tree that I told you? You know, like, you just, it smacks of just like the garden language. Elisha knows. And he says, your servant went nowhere. Lie number two, verse 26. Listen to this.
And he said to him, did not my heart go when the man turned from his chariot to meet you? Was it a and oxen, male servants and female servants.
What is Elisha saying? Number one, my heart was there. So I wasn't there, but I knew what was going on, which is creepy. So, like, yeah, I watched that whole thing go down. So, secondly, is it a time to receive money, to receive clothes, olive groves, vineyards, sheep, oxen, male and female servants? What is he saying? Is it appropriate to take from this guy? No. Now, is there a time that it is appropriate to be paid for services rendered underneath the name of the Lord? Yes, that's totally appropriate. And Elisha said, this is not it. This would have been misconstrued. This would have been, in Naaman's eyes, somehow lessened what happened in that moment between he and God. I don't want to interfere with this. This is not the time. Now, I'm a prophet, right? I make my money just like you do, Gehazi, ministering to the people. We're provided by the people. They take care of us. That's fine. This isn't the time for that. And I told you that. 27, therefore, the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and to your descendants forever. So he went down from his presence as a leper as white as snow. Rough ending to our boy Gehazi's life, okay? This is a great passage, by the way, for those of you guys that will get into this. When I say full-time ministry, I mean full-time ministry. To teach to pastors, right? I've heard this taught in a pastor's context, right? What would be the lesson here for men and women that are in full-time ministry?
Don't use your authority for gain.
Yeah. We were in seminary, and I remember our one of our seminary profs saying, you know, everybody that goes into ministry, you know, they say it's a, you know, you're going to be poor. Like, man, that is not the case. Like, if you want to go make money in ministry, you can go make a grip of money in ministry, right? I'm in some convenience store with my kids last Saturday, driving to Sacramento to go watch one of my kids play soccer. And I walk in a convenience store, and on the television, there's Joel Osteen, like, bringing it. Like, I don't even want to use that term. He's doing whatever Joel Osteen does in a pulpit, which is not preaching or bringing it. That guy is stupid. Stupid rich, but he's sold out, right? There's no gospel in his message. There's no, I mean, he's just as off as the day is long. But has he put himself in a position to go make a ton of money? Absolutely. Now, is making money in ministry wrong? No, right? There's people that need to be rightly compensated, but there are folks out there that see the ministry as an opportunity to go make money. And it's all about moving up the ladder and prestige and fame and position so that I can go make more and more money. And Gehazi was guilty of that. He wanted to be paid. He wanted to be compensated for what he did in this moment. That wasn't right. He knew it wasn't right. Elisha knew it wasn't right. And his heart turned sour on him. So be careful for those of you guys that go down that road. You need to be compensated. You need to be appropriately compensated, right? But there is opportunity to take advantage of relationships, to take advantage of generous people around you. Being in the ministry and being in a nonprofit work, I have never in my life been exposed to so many ridiculously generous people. I mean, mind-blowingly generous with their stuff, with their money, with their time. It's amazing. And there's every opportunity to take advantage of that if I'm not careful, and that's going to be the same for a lot of you guys. So just be aware of that. You need to be taken care of, but there's a line somewhere in there, so just be cognizant of it, okay? So, unfortunate ending for our boy Gehazi. Naaman ends up all good, worshiping God on Israeli dirt in a foreign land, and Elisha brings a pretty hard message, okay? Now, 6 verse 1, we see now another miracle of Elijah. I think we're on like miracle, I don't know, like 8 or something like that. I've got a chart somewhere that I never gave you guys. It's not that important, but he does 14 total. 11. We're at 11, apparently. There it is in my notes, okay? He raises an axe head. So this guy's chopping trees. They drop an axe head in the water. Axe head sinks. He makes it float. So, cool. So, moving on, okay? Verse 8 now. Let's pick up there. Chapter 6, verse 8.
Now the king of Syria was making war against Israel, and he consulted with his servants, saying, my camp will be in such and such a place, and the man of God sent to the king of Israel, saying, Beware, that you do not pass this place, for the Syrians are coming down there.
All right, so the idea is the king of Aram is at war with Israel, and he's telling his servants, man, here's where we're going to go. We're going to camp here, and it's all stealthy, right? And Elisha finds out about it, right? And he tells the king of Israel, hey, by the way, there's a raid coming. He's coming this way. He's going to camp in this town. And his plans keep getting thwarted. And the king of Aram's like, what the heck? Like, how is this happening? How do they know where I'm going to be? One of you's a mole. Somebody in my, like, inner ring is lying against me, okay? The heart of the king in verse 11 was enraged. Will you tell me which one of us is for the king of Israel? Which one of you is on the other team? Because somebody clearly is, because this guy shouldn't know the business. Listen, verse 12. No, my lord, O king, but Elisha, the prophet who's in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom. Like, this guy knows everything. We're not moles. This guy just, man, God's revealing everything to him. So obviously the king of Aram is pretty upset about that. Go see, verse 13, he says where he is, that I might send him and take him. So he wants to take his life. Verse 15, let's pick up there.
And when the servant of the man of God arose early and went out, there was an army surrounding the city with horses and chariots, and his servant said to him, alas, my master, what shall we do?
That's a problem. When you walk outside your city and the enemy camp is all around you, you're like, oh, crud. Problem. Keep rolling.
So he answered, do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them.
Which is not the case. They're way outnumbered. But Elisha sees something that no one else does. 17.
And Elijah prayed and said, Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see. Then the Lord opened his eyes of the young man and saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha.
All right, so angels, more than likely, appear to everybody else that Elisha could see, but no one else could see. Now, 12th miracle, so he sees all these armies from the Lord that had lined up to do battle with them. When they came down to Elisha and prayed to the Lord and said, strike this people with blindness, I pray. So Elisha prays that this enemy army would all go blind. He struck them according to the blindness, according to Elisha. Then Elisha says to this pagan army, this is not the way, nor is this the city. Hey, guys, you're all in the wrong place. You want to attack this other city, follow me. Okay, so this pagan army is now following Elisha because they're all blind. Came about when they came into Samaria, the capital of the Israeli king. Elisha said, O Lord, now open their eyes that they may see. The Lord opened their eyes and they saw, behold, they were in the midst of Samaria. Okay, that's not where you want to be when you show up blindfolded in a place, by the way. At the house of the king of Israel, 21, and all his armies. And he basically says, in 21, the king of Israel, when he saw them, said, my father, shall I kill them? Like, they're all sitting ducks. They've all just kind of marched into our hometown. We have them surrounded. Then God removes their blindness, and the king of Israel says, can we just slaughter them all? Okay, and Elisha says, not so much. 22.
But he answered, you shall not kill them. Would you kill those whom you have taken captive with your sword and your bow? Set food and water before them, and they may eat and drink and go to their master.
So wait, this is a pagan army that marches into Israel. God shows this miracle. King of Israel wants to kill them. And what's Elisha's answer? Not only are you not going to kill them, what are you going to do? You're going to feed them. You're going to take care of them. And then what are you going to let them do? Just go home. Go home to your master. Like, okay, this is an odd battle plan. Okay. So they prepared a great feast. They had eaten and drunk. He sent them away, and they went to their master. And the marauding bands of the Arameans did not come again into the land of Israel. So did this work? Absolutely. An odd plan, but it is how it ultimately went down. Okay. 24 now. Ben-Hadad, the king of Aram, the same guy that we just read about, now decides to change his mind that he's never going to come into Israel again, but he does. Gathered all his army and went up and besieged Samaria. Okay. 25, there was a great famine in Samaria, and behold, they besieged it. So if there's a famine in the land of Israel, why would you guys guess that's going on? What have we continued to see with God in famines? Right? Idolatry, bad stuff. See also the right-hand side of your chart. It's all black, so there's evil in the land. God is bringing in Samaria, rather, not in Judah, but in Samaria, a famine. So it's a localized famine. And he gives some, he tells you how bad it is. So this is really helpful. In 25, a donkey's head sold for 80 shekels of silver, a fourth of a cob of dove's dung sold for 5 shekels of silver. I don't know how often you guys go to the market and buy dove's dung and a donkey's head, but whenever I do, they're way cheaper than that. So the idea is they're eating whatever they can find, and they will pay exorbitant prices for it because there's a famine. So if you're eating dove poop, look, you got bigger issues. So King of Israel was passing by a wall of a woman, and she cries out to him and says, "Oh, Lord, my king." And he said in verse 27, this is great theology from a pagan king. Somebody read that.
And he said, "If the Lord does not help you, if the Lord does not help you, where can I find help for you?"
So she's crying out to the king saying, "Fix this." And he says, "What? I can't fix this." It's just like when Naaman says, "Hey, will you cure me of leprosy?" He's like, "Am I God? Like, can I do that? I can't do that. That God does that." But he won't bow his knee to God. And he says, "Here, look, if God doesn't fix this situation, no one's going to fix this situation. But I'm not going to turn to that God because I kind of really like my life the way it is. From the threshing floor, from the wine press, like, can anything fix this? No." 28, this is how bad it is in this land at this day.
And the king said to her, "What is troubling you?" And she answered, "The woman, this woman said to me, give your son, and that we may eat him today, and that we may eat his, my son tomorrow." So we boiled my son and ate him. And I said to her, on the next day, "Give me your son that we may eat him." But she has hidden her son.
Oh. Oh. That's dark. So they're coming before the king of Israel saying, "Hey, can you fix this problem?" Kind of like Solomon and cutting the kid in half thing. And he's so outraged by what he's just heard. Like, "I'm sorry, you ate your child? And the other mother now won't offer her child? And you want me to punish her for you guys not being able to eat him today?" He doesn't know what to do. Verse 30, "It came about when the king heard the words of the woman, he tore his clothes while he was passing by the wall, and the people looked, and behold, he had sackcloth beneath his body." What does that mean? Beneath on his body. What does he have over the sackcloth? His royal robes. Why does he have sackcloth underneath those? What is it? What is sackcloth a sign of? Mourning, repentance. So he's disgusted and repenting of what he hears, but he doesn't wear sackcloth externally. Why? For everyone to see plainly. Why not?
Keeping up appearances.
Appearances. He repents, kinda. He repents in his heart a little, but not nationwide. He won't lead that. He won't lead the nation to that to say, "Man, this is awful. This is horrible. This is some of the worst stuff that we've ever seen in our scriptures. People eating their children. This is bad. Bad, bad." But he won't repent of it totally because he doesn't want it to affect his job, his position, whatever it may be. He said in verse 31, "May God do so to me and even more if the head of Elisha, the son of Shabbat, remains on him today." So, by the way, whose fault is all this? Elisha's. Like, wow, what a jacked up theology. 32, Elisha was sitting in his house. The elders were sitting with him. The king sent a man in his presence and said, "Go get him." He says, "Do you see the son of a murderer has sent to take away my head?" Meaning Ahab's dad. This is who we're dealing with now. Jehoram. He wants me dead. 33, while he was still talking with them, behold, a messenger came down, and behold, this evil is from the Lord. Why should I wait for the Lord any longer? So they're seeing now that God's wrath is on this people. They want to blame Elisha. It's not Elisha's fault. God's brought this famine because they're living stupid, and that's basically the case, okay? Elisha says, "You're going to see the hand of God," verse 1 of chapter 7, tomorrow. Read this.
But Elisha said, "Hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord, tomorrow about this time, the seah of fine flour shall be sold for a shekel, and 2 seahs of barley for a shekel."
Meaning, the famine's going to be over tomorrow, and you're going to be able to buy a ton of stuff for very little money. The opposite of what we're in right now. Tomorrow, okay? The royal officer who hears this news says, behold, if the Lord should make windows in heaven, could this thing be? If God dropped animals out of the sky, could you solve a famine in 24 hours? No, we can't grow stuff. We can't have water. We can't have a harvest. Like, there's not enough time. Like, God can't do this. He couldn't provide, like, manna from heaven, could he? Well, let's see. So, there's this idea of unbelief, right? And then Elisha says to him, behold, you shall see it with your own eyes, but you shall not eat of it. Meaning, you don't believe that my God can do this. You're going to see it, and then you're going to die. And you're not even going to get the taste of the riches that God is going to bring this time tomorrow. Okay? Let's watch how God ends this famine. Verse 3.
Now there were four men who were lepers at the entrance to the gate. And they said to one another, why are we sitting here until we die?
Meaning what? They were already lepers. Our life's horrible. We can sit here and die, or we can at least try to go get food and die. Either way, we're going to die. So let's at least see if we can die full.
If we say, let us enter the city, the famine is in the city, and we shall die there. And if we sit here, we die also. So now come, let us go over to the camp of the Syrians. If they spare our lives, we shall live. And if they kill us, we shall but...
Great idea. Let's march into any enemy camp, and let's just see what happens. They have food. So if they kill us, we're going to die either way. But if they don't kill us and spare us, then dinner. So great idea. So these guys are nuts, but go for it, okay? Watch what happens in verse 5.
So they arose at twilight to go to the camp of the Syrians. But when they came to the edge of the camp of the Syrians, behold, there was no one there.
Okay, that's odd. So you got an entire camp of the Assyrians that are now just gone. Okay, keep going.
Raptured. For the Lord had made of the Syrians hear the sound of chariots and of horses, the sound of a great army, so that they said to one another, behold, the king of Israel has hired against us the king of the Hittites and the kings of Egypt to come against us.
So they hear what they think is this gigantic army. It's four lepers walking up. God causes this. They all panic and say, man, we're all going to die. We should leave, like, quick, fast, and hurry right now. So they came and arose. They fled at twilight. They left their tents, their houses, their donkeys, even the camp just as it was, and fled for their life. They didn't take a thing. They just ran out of Dodge. Verse 8, the lepers came to the outskirts of the camp. They entered one tent, and they ate and drank, and they carried from there the silver and the gold and the clothes. They went and hid them. They returned and entered another tent, carried away there. I mean, it's like this massive buffet. And when you're done with buffet, it's like, I'll take some silver. I'll take a change of clothes. I'll take that Rolex. Like, this is... there's four guys that are plundering a camp. Like, this is crazy. Now, verse 9, this is fantastic. Listen to what one of these lepers says.
Then they said to one another, we are not doing right. This day is a day of good news. If we are silent and wait until the morning light, punishment will overtake us.
What does that mean? What is he saying?
We shouldn't keep this to ourselves.
We can't keep this to ourselves. Dude, we are mowing on food. God has provided. How dare us enjoy this bounty and not tell anybody else? You guys know who Bill Hybels is, pastor of Willow Creek Community Church up in Chicago? I heard him give a message on evangelism, and he used this text to do it, and it was this right here. Like, we are enjoying the bounty, the provision of God. Like, we have heard from him, we have seen him move, and we're hiding it. We're keeping this all to ourselves, and God is going to punish us if that's the life we live. And they said, we have got to go back. So they walk back into Samaria, and they go tell the people of the good news. Okay, so they walked and came to the city in verse 10 to the gatekeepers and told them, behold, we came to the camp of the Arameans. There was nobody there, no voice of man, only horses tied and donkeys. And the gatekeepers told it within the king's house. Verse 12, the king arose that night and said to his servants, I will now tell you what the Arameans have done to us. They know that we are hungry, therefore they have gone from the camp to hide themselves in the field. When they come out of the city, they will capture us alive and get to the city. So the king hears about this, and what does he think the Arameans are doing? He's basically saying, this is a trap. They're hiding in the wilderness. They're wanting us all to come in. They're wanting you to bring this message, and then they're going to attack us while we're mowing on their buffet. Okay, that's the idea. He says, man, that's not the case. Verse 13, at the very end of it all, the leper says, come and see. Send and see. Come with me, and you're going to see that's not the case. They're not there. They are gone. Verse 14, go and see. Verse 16, the people sent out and plundered the camp of the Arameans. Then a measure of fine flour was sold for a shekel, two measures of barley for a shekel, according to the word of the Lord. So does God solve the problem of the famine in 24 hours, just like he said he would? Through a crazy means, right? Through voices in the heads of Arameans, they scatter and now they have food, okay? Now the guy that didn't believe it, the royal officer, he gets to see it, but he doesn't get to eat it. Here's how his day ends in verse 17. He gets run over. Like, this is like Walmart on Black Friday, right? He gets trampled in the gate as everyone's running to go get food. So it's a rough ending, but man, I guess you should have believed God is the lesson there. So rough day, okay? So anyway, you see a really cool story of how God provides in the midst of a famine for the people through a crazy string of events. And again, you're seeing throughout this book, it's bad, but God is still present, and God is still showing up, and God is still ministering to the people through crazy ways. Okay, 8 verse 1. You guys remember the gal who didn't have a kid, and Elisha promised her a kid. Then God took her kid. See also same woman. 8 verse 1. The woman whose son had he had restored his life to. She had now fled during this time because Elisha told her there's going to be a famine for 7 years. She leaves town, goes to the Philistines, according to verse 2. Lives there for 7 years because there's food there. Comes back into town. And in verse 4, the king, Joram, was talking with Gehazi and saying, please relate to me all the great things that Elisha has done. So they're talking about how God has used Elisha to minister. And it comes during this conversation that this woman comes back into town. And after the king of Israel hears all that Elisha has done during his ministry, verse 6, watch how God takes care of this woman who comes back at the end of a famine.
Verse 6.
Mm-hmm.
And when the king asked the woman, she told him, so the king appointed certain officers for her, saying, restore all that was hers and all that the proceeds of the field from the day that she left until of the land until now.
So she gets her land back, and all the proceeds that would have been from the field, had they not been in a famine, she gets all those as well. So God, through Elisha, says, hey, tell this woman to leave. Go take refuge in Philistia for 7 years, then come back, and you're going to get all your stuff back, plus all the stuff that didn't grow for 7 years, you're going to get that back as well. So just a cool provision, and it's based on Elisha's character, Elisha's reputation. The king is so enamored with what God has done through him. He won't repent, but nonetheless, she gets taken care of, okay? Now, 8 verse 7, the message that was originally given to Elijah to anoint Hazazel, the new king, over Aram, now is going to take place, okay? Elisha is going to be the guy that does it. So 8:7, let's pick up there.
Then Elisha went to Damascus, and Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, was sick. And when it was told to him, saying, the man of God has come here, and the king said to Hazael, take a present in your hand and go meet the man of God and inquire of the Lord by him, saying, shall I recover from this disease?
All right, so Ben-Hadad's sick, the current king of Syria, okay, and he tells his servant Hazazel, okay, this is his right-hand man, go meet Elisha. I hear he's in town. Take a present with you and find out from him if I'm going to get better or if I'm going to die, okay? So he goes, Hazazel goes out, by the way, in verse 9, with 40 camels' loads of gifts. 40 camels show up, each camel bearing a gift. One camel with one gift would have been a lot. He brings 40. What is the king of Aram doing? What is Ben-Hadad doing with Elisha? Bribing him. Okay? So Elisha says, end of verse 9, he finds out and he wants to know, man, is he going to get better? Oh, and here are all the camels that I brought with me with gifts on them. Elisha, is my master, Ben-Hadad, going to get better? Verse 10. Elisha says to him, you shall surely recover. Yes, you're going to get better, but the Lord has shown me that he will certainly die. What does that mean? You're going to get better, but you're going to die. Are you going to die of this sickness? No, but you're going to die, and we're going to find out how, okay? So, he's telling this to Hazael, and then in verse 11, he, Elisha, fixes his eyes on him, Hazael, okay, until he was ashamed, and the man of God wept. Elisha, as he's communicating this message that his master, Ben-Hadad's going to get better, is basically in a stare down with Hazael, and he begins to weep because Elisha knows what's coming. Hazael says to him, "Why do you weep? Why are you crying?" And in verse 12, he says, "Because I know the evil that you will do to the sons of Israel. You are an evil man, and I know what's coming." He knows this guy is going to be the next king, okay? You're going to take the sons of Israel, their strongholds, you will set on fire. The young men you will kill with the sword, their little ones you will dash in pieces, and their women with child you will rip up, meaning you're going to kill everybody. You're going to be ruthless, and what's coming for Israel is awful. I know what's going to happen. Hazael in verse 13 says, "Oh, what is your servant? I'm just a dog. I'm a nobody." Like he's feigning like that's not really his character. And at the end of 13, Elisha says, "The Lord has shown me that you will be king over Aram. You're going to be the next king, and it's not for the good of Israel. God is using you to inflict punishment on Israel for their disobedience, and that's what's going to occur." Okay. Now, 14, let's see if Elisha's promise comes true of him healing but dying.
"Then he departed from Elisha and came to his master and said to him, 'What did Elisha say to you?' And he answered, 'He told me you would surely recover.' But it happened on the next day that he took a thick cloth and dipped it in water and spread it over his face so that he died, and Hazael reigned in his place."
So what does Hazael do to Ben-Hadad? Guy takes a wet wath cloth, basically waterboards the guy and kills him. So great, now I'm the king. So like, was Elisha right? Is this guy wicked evil? Yep. So he murders the king and then takes his job. Okay, it's a rough deal. Okay, now back to the south. You've got Joram currently on the throne, and let's watch what happens underneath his ministry. Okay, in verse 17. Or pick up in 16 there. "In the fifth year of Joram, the son of Ahab," so the Israeli king, the king of the north, "Jehoshaphat being the king of Judah, Joram, the son of Jehoshaphat, became king." So Jehoshaphat's done. His son Jehoram is now the new king. So we have two kings with the same name, one in the south, one in the north, reigning at the same time. Okay. "He walked in the way of the kings of Israel just as the house of Ahab had done." So he's evil, just like the kings in the north. "For the daughter of Ahab became his wife." We talked about this earlier. So now Ahab, who was king in the north, sent his daughter to Jehoshaphat, to the king in the south. And his son, Joram, Jehoshaphat's son Joram, ends up marrying this gal named Athaliah. And she is wicked. She is awful. Not quite as bad as Jezebel, but she's pretty bad. So now you've got evil in both places. You've got evil from the north now, spreading to the evil in the south. So Jehoshaphat, bless his heart, I told you guys he was Odie. He's just good-hearted but stupid. In all of his efforts to unite the two kingdoms, he went too far. And now he's got to deal with this. And his son has to deal with the aftermath of his stupid decisions of bringing in this queen. And she has no desire to just be queen. She wants to be king, if you will. She wants to be the woman in charge of all of Israel. So, and she is evil as the day is long, okay? So, it's a bad deal in the south now as well. Verse 24, Joram slept with his fathers. In verse 24, 2 Chronicles tells us that God literally cursed his bowels because he went and slayed all of his brothers. Okay, so he didn't want there to be a coup if he died. So he killed all of his own brothers, and God killed him. And it says he literally had a disease of his bowels. So you guys figure out what that is. I don't know. Okay, but at this point now you've got basically a... you'll see on your chart, it's called the Athaliah Rebellion. So for 7 years, this queen is the acting king, okay, who is the daughter of Ahab from the north. So this is not a good situation. You can tell, if I could make that blacker, I would have. She is not a pleasant woman, okay? So now, verse 25, let's pick up there, 8:25.
"In the 25th year of Joram, the son of Ahab, the king of Israel, the king of Joram, the king of Judah, began to reign, and Ahaziah is his name.
Sorry, dude. These are all weird.
Was 22 years old and when he became king, and he reigned over 1 year over in Jerusalem. His mother's name was
Athaliah. Yeah, so that's the guy we just read about. Okay.
The granddaughter of Omri, the king of Israel. And when he walked in the ways of the house of Ahab, and did evil in the sight of the Lord.
Okay, so it's, again, we got a bad situation. We got Ahaziah on the throne, but Athaliah will soon be the queen on the block. They went down to Joram, verse 28, the son of Ahab against Hazael, the king of Aram. So they're trying to, again, reunite to deal with the pagan nations that are coming in. Ahaziah, end of verse 29, we'll start at the beginning of verse 29. King Joram returned to be healed in Jezreel by the wounds which the Arameans inflicted on him in battle. Then Ahaziah, son of Jehoram, king of Judah, went down to see Joram, the son of Ahab, in Jezreel because he was sick. So now you've got the northern king and the southern king in the same place. Okay, one of them has been wounded in battle, and the other says, you know what, I should go see him. I should bring him a Hallmark card. I should wish him the best. Okay, enter now, chapter 9, verse 1, Jehu, as we call him. Okay, Jehu is the basically captain of the northern king's army. And this is the guy that is going to be used to kind of eradicate a bit of the evil that is currently there. Okay, so Elisha says, God wants this guy to be the next king. He's going to deal with all the false worship and all the paganism that's going on right now. And he sends one of his servants. Elisha doesn't even go, which is interesting because Elijah wouldn't anoint this guy. Elisha wouldn't anoint this guy. Elisha sends his servant to do it. So I don't know how much grief we want to give Elijah for not doing it. Elisha basically sends his servants as well. And basically, Elisha says, hey, go meet this guy, tell him what you need to tell him, and then leave immediately. Don't stay for lunch, okay? This guy is, he's the Terminator. He's going to kill everything. He has no heart. He actually does some great stuff for God, but he's just a, he kills everybody. Once he's done killing everybody, he doesn't really know what to do. So Elisha's servant comes down, gives him this message. End of verse 6, I have anointed you king over the people of the Lord, even over Israel. Now, the current king of Israel is still alive, okay? Elisha comes in through his servant and says, Jehu, you're the new king. And he says, sweet, that sounds awesome, okay? He goes on in verse 7 and says, you shall strike the house of Ahab your master, so I want vengeance on the house of Ahab for their evil. God wants that dealt with. The blood of his prophets, the blood of the servants at the hand of Jezebel, we're going to deal with her because she is evil. For the whole house of Ahab shall perish. I will cut off every male from the house of Ahab, both free and bond in Israel. So we're going to deal finally now with the evil of Ahab and his wife Jezebel from that pagan land. And Jehu, you're going to be the instrument that God is going to use to do that. Verse 9, I will make the house of Ahab like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nabot, like the house of Baasha, the son of Ahijah, meaning there was a former king. You guys remember Baasha came in and he basically cleaned a lineage out. Jehu is going to do the exact same thing to Ahab's house, okay? All of his remaining sons that are alive. In verse 10, here's the promise of now what's going to happen to Jezebel, and I frankly kind of like this.
Verse 10.
Mm-hmm.
Dog shall eat Jezebel on the plot of ground at Jezreel, and there shall be none to bury her. And he opened the door and fled.
Okay, so Jezebel's going to get eaten by dogs because she's evil. Okay, so sorry, Jezebel, I don't care for you, and I don't think I'm going to have to talk to her in heaven anyway. So that's actually rude. I'm sorry. She's bad. So she's going to get eaten by dogs. So that's a bad way to end your life, okay? So Jehu says, great, game on. Verse 13, all his servants find out about this message. They say, let's anoint you king. They anoint him king. They have like a little private party. So now we kind of have two kings in Israel, the current, and then Jehu's kind of who the new king, okay? So he conspired against Joram, the current king, in verse 14. And he says, all right, we're going to do what God said to do, which was basically eradicate this. So he starts actually, it looks to be pretty good. So he comes in and basically in 15 and following says, we're going to eradicate both of these guys. And he finds out again that Ahaziah, king of Judah, had come down to see Joram. So he's like, great, I got two kings in the same place. I'll just kill them all. This is fantastic. Verse 18, Jehu's coming in town where the two kings are. And they send out servants because they see Jehu coming, and they say, hey, is this peace? And he basically says, no, I'm not coming with a peaceful message. Leave. They send another group of people out, 19, asking if it's peace. And he says, man, get away from me. This is not about peace. Verse 20, he's driving his chariot like a madman, and they realize, oh, gosh, this is not good. So this guy is not coming for peace. 21, Joram said, get ready, and they made his chariot ready. Joram, king of Israel, and Ahaziah, king of Judah, went out. So both these kings now, one in the north and one in the south, go out to meet Jehu at the property of Naboth. You guys remember the vineyard that Ahab bought from this guy, that horrible story? They go out to meet him, and they ask the question, why are you here? Is this peace? You're my military commander. Why are you showing up in this situation? And they realize, oh gosh, he doesn't want peace. Verse 24, here's what he wants.
And Jehu drew his bow with his full strength and shot Joram between the shoulders so that the arrow pierced his heart and he sank in his chariot.
All right, so we got Northern King. He's dead. Okay, 25, moving on.
Jehu said to Bidkar, his aide, take him up and throw him on the plot of ground belonging to Naboth, the Jezreelite. For remember when you and I rode side by side behind Ahab, his father, how the Lord made this pronouncement against him.
So he apparently was in that battle, and he was made to go take Naboth's land by Ahab, and as payback for what they had to do, which he thought was evil, he takes this guy's body, just dumps it, and says, man, forget about him, he's evil. So there, payback, okay? 27, Ahaziah, the king of Judah, saw this and thinks, oh man, this is not good. So Jehu persuaded him and said, shoot him too in his chariot. So they shoot him in verse 27. So now we got both kings dead. So the king in the north, king in the south, they're both dead. No king in the south at this point. And now we're going to deal in verse 30 with Jezebel. Okay, Jehu came to Jezreel. Jezebel hears about this, and she painted her eyes, adorned her head, and then looks out the window. So she gets dressed up all fancy, stands in the loft of her palace in Jezreel, and says to him in verse 31, is it well, Zimri, your master's murderer? So she calls him Zimri, who was a guy who about 45 years before had done very similar, had wiped out the line, he would kill people. And he's speaking to her as she's on her balcony and she's punking him, basically knowing while he's here, like, okay, you've killed the other kings, you're on my doorstep now, I know what's coming, I'm just dressing myself up for my funeral so no one else has to do it for me, okay? Verse 32, this is fascinating.
And he lifted up his face to the window and said, who's on my side? Who? Two or three eunuchs looked out at him.
So he's talking to her up in the balcony. He says, are any of you guys on my team? Or are you still for Jezebel? And two or three eunuchs come forward and say, yeah, we're with you. And this is what he requests of them.
He said, throw her down.
Okay, fair enough.
So they threw her down, and some of her blood splattered on the wall and on the horses, and they trampled on her.
Okay, so not a pleasant death. So she gets tossed off the balcony, obviously dies. Not a pretty sight. Okay, so he runs her over in his chariot. Then he goes in verse 34 to have lunch. You kind of get an idea what this guy's like. Thrown off the wall, runs her over, gets out of his chariot, was like, oh, my bad. And then goes in and eats lunch and then realizes, oh, we left her outside. We should probably do something with that pagan woman's hideous body. 35, they went out to bury her, but they found no one, no more of her than the skull of her feet and the palms of her hands. How was she supposed to die? By dogs. Therefore, they returned and said, this is the word of the Lord. In the property of Jezreel, the dogs shall eat the flesh of Jezebel. So as they were having lunch, so were the dogs. Okay, so that is the end of Jezebel. So odd story, but this is Jehu. He is just he's the Terminator. He's killed Jezebel. He's killed both of the kings, one in Israel, one in Judah. And it's a bad deal. Now he's going to deal with the rest of Ahab's line. 10 verse 1, he has 70 remaining sons, apparently, that are still around. And he says, man, we're going to deal with them too. So he sends word and says, man, I want all those sons basically dead. Verse 3, this is the letter that he sends basically requesting their death.
You want to start at verse 2?
Sure.
Now, as soon as the letter has come to you, since your master's sons are with you, and you have the chariots and horses. Fortify a fortified city also, and weapons. Choose the best qualified of your master's sons. Set him on his father's throne and fight for your master's house.
All right, so take one of Ahab's kid, pick the best, we don't care which one it is, put him on the throne, okay? And we're going to fight for our house, fight for Ahab's house. But they feared greatly and said, man, the two kings did not stand before him. How shall we stand? Like, Ahab's killing, or Jehu's killing everybody. Like, that's a dumb idea. We're not going to stand up against this guy. Verse 5, they hear about this, and Jehu says, man, you want to do this the easy way? You want to do this the hard way? We are your servants. All that we say to us you will do. We will not make any man king today. Do what is good in your sight. So, okay, that was a bad idea. Jehu, you just tell us what you want us to do. We're not going to fight you because we realize this is going to end poorly. And he says, I'll tell you what. Verse 6, if you are on my side and you will listen to my voice, take the heads of the men, your master's sons, and come to me at Jezreel tomorrow about this time. So I would like, in end of verse 6, the king's sons, 70 heads of the sons in a basket delivered to me tomorrow in Jezreel. Okay, so very clear. You kill them all, and you bring me their heads. And if you bring me 70 heads, we're going to be in a good place. If not, I will go get the heads myself, is basically what he's saying. Verse 7, it came about when the letter came to them that they took the king's sons, slaughtered them, 70 sons, put their heads in baskets, and sent them to Jezreel. So, yikes. So this is like just mass carnage. Everybody is dying. And because, again, of Ahab's wickedness, his line is paying for it, and they are wicked as well. So he gets the heads that he's wanted. He's putting an end to Ahab's house. Verse 11. So Jehu killed all the remaining of the house of Ahab in Jezreel. They're all done. He comes and meets now another group of people in verse 12 that don't know who he is, and he asks them, "Hey, who are you guys?" And they're like, "Hey, we're coming to meet Ahab and his family. Woohoo!" And Ahab's like, "Dude," or Jehu says, "You're on the wrong team." He kills all them as well, 13 and 14. And then in 15 and following, there's this guy by the name of Jonadab who says, man, let's go do something basically at least a little bit righteous, right? You're killing a bunch of people. You need to join me, and let's go deal with the Baal worship that started all this, okay? 18, Jehu is now going to deal with all the worshipers of Baal and kill them, okay? This is actually maybe the only bright spot in this guy's life, minus that he's killed a bunch of pagan kings, so... verse 18, somebody pick up there.
Then Jehu assembled all the people and said to them, Ahab served Baal a little, but Jehu will serve him much.
Now that's an understatement. Ahab served him a little, I'm going to serve him much, which is a lie, but he's saying, listen, if you thought Ahab was loyal to Baal, you hadn't seen anything yet. I'm going to be super loyal. So he basically says, all y'all get in a building, we're going to have a gigantic like worship service to Baal. Everybody that worships him, you be here and all get in this building. Okay, you can see where this is going. Then he tells his servants in verse 24, the one who permits any of these men whom I bring into your hands to escape shall give up his life in exchange. You bring them all in a building. You shut the doors. We're going to fake a worship service. And if anybody who worships Baal leaves this building while you're guarding the doors, I'm going to kill you instead. Okay, so verse 25, pick up there and let's watch how Jehu deals with Baal worship.
So as soon as he had made an end of offering the burnt offering, Jehu said to the guard and to the officers, go in and strike them down. Let not a man escape. So when they put them to the sword, the guard and the officers cast them out and went into the inner room of the house of Baal. And they brought out the pillar that was in the house of Baal and burned it. And they demolished the pillar of Baal and demolished the house of Baal and made it a latrine to this day.
That's awesome. So this is what a former house of a pagan god is worth. It's a latrine to this day. So when you go to Israel, that's where all the outhouses are. Okay, so fantastic. Verse 28, Jehu eradicated Baal out of Israel. So he's killed a whole bunch of people. He does something that looks good, eradicates all this from this sin from the land. However, the problem is in verse 29. Jehu did not depart even the golden calves that were from Bethel and from Dan. He didn't fully worship God. God says, man, you've done what I've asked you to do. I'm going to be gracious to your house. Problem is verse 31, Jehu was not careful to walk in the law of the Lord, the God of Israel, with all his heart. He did not depart from the sons of Jeroboam, which he made in Israel. Okay, and we'll pick up on the rest of this story tomorrow. But the idea is this guy continued to worship the false gods that Jeroboam had set up years and years ago, one in Dan and one in Bethel. Okay, so we're seeing the eradication of the evil lines of the north at the hand of Jehu, and we'll pick up on, again, more of that in the manana. All right, so enjoy your Thursday. We will see you bright and early tomorrow.